Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by and welcome to today's Old Fashioned Underwriting Teleconference. All parties are currently in listen-only mode. After the presentation, a question-and-answer session will be conducted at the moderator's discretion. At that time, if you would like to ask a question or make a comment, please press 7 on your touch-tone keypad. I would now like to turn the conference over to Tracy O'Malley.
Hello, everyone. My name is Tracy O'Malley, and I'm the Executive Director of the PLUS Group. We would like to thank you for taking the time today to join us for the PLUS Group DI Day Training Live Audio Conference. Today's topic is old-fashioned underwriting and will be presented to you by Jim Poland of Standard Insurance. Hopefully, you have the presentation so that you can follow along. It was included along with the invitation for this audio conference. If you don't have it, you can go to our website at www.plusgroupus.com. And on the right side of the page, it says Upcoming Conferences. And below that, you will click where it says Old Fashioned Underwriting. And it'll take you to another page, and you will see the presentations on the bottom of that page. It's available in either PowerPoint or PDF formats. We hope that you enjoy the presentation, and as mentioned, you will have an opportunity to ask questions at the end of the audio conference. Again, thanks, and I'm going to turn this over to Jim.
Thanks, Tracy. Good morning or good afternoon to everyone, depending on what time zone you're in. A pleasure to participate with you today in this webinar. As Tracy said, our topic is old-fashioned underwriting, a program provided by Standard Insurance, and so we'll just get right to it. At the Standard, we, of course, focus on disability insurance, and as you hopefully know, we provide disability income insurance as well as business overhead and buyout, buy-sell coverage. We recognize that in some ways a process of obtaining disability insurance can sometimes take on a life of its own. From the insurer side of the equation, there's a pretty simple reason for that. When you consider that a policy pays, paying our maximum of $15,000 in benefit, it could easily pay out $5.5 million on a 30-year claim. So the insurance company certainly has a lot at risk, and that's just on one claim. So the insurer basically gets one bite of the apple, one chance to view a snapshot of the applicant's health history and their occupation and assess the risk and hopefully issue a policy. So they have to do a good job, a thorough job, and not just for the insurance company's sake, but for the insured's sake, because everybody wants a company to be around and be able to pay the claims that they promised to pay. On the applicant side of the equation, however, and by association, your side, the producer side, the process can be overwhelming, and the lengthy applications, dozens of questions, the need for reams of financial documentation, et cetera, et cetera. So we understand that. And we want to make it a simpler process. So we want to go back in time when it wasn't as complicated as it is. And so we've come up with a simpler approach, old-fashioned underwriting. If you turn to the second slide, this kind of gives an idea of who we're targeting, who should take advantage of old-fashioned underwriting. First off, it's for producers who haven't really tried selling DI in the past because maybe they think the process is too complicated. They've heard stories from their colleagues, or maybe they just heard my opening remarks just now from the last slide, and they've gravitated to other products that seem to offer an easier, more straightforward process. Or maybe they're relatively new in the business and just haven't tried their hand at disability insurance. It's also aimed at more seasoned producers who maybe used to sell more disability insurance before it got so complicated, but they've fallen away from it in recent years as the process has kind of snowballed. Lastly, it's also just for producers who do a good deal of disability insurance but who wanted to simplify the process, at least in those cases that meet the guidelines that we're going to talk about in a minute. Old-fashioned underwriting doesn't apply to all applications and doesn't fit all situations, but it certainly can be a good tool for a certain segment of the market. So in any case, it's designed to make the sales process easier for everyone involved. So how does it do that? Well, if you turn to page number three, here are really the four main features of old-fashioned underwriting. It's a simple, streamlined approach that dispenses with the need for any medical exam or test. So no blood draws, no urine samples, no mini exams, no EKGs, nothing. It also dispenses with the need for attending physician statements. So we don't send out for any doctor records. There's no personal history interview, no answering the same questions over again, questions that have already been answered in the application. And lastly, there's no income documentation. So no need to produce pay stubs or tax records. Now, there is one exception to that, and that is if someone is applying for our business owner upgrade, then we do need to see the past 2 years of tax returns. For those of you unfamiliar with our business owner upgrade, it's an enhancement that we offer to business owners, which allows them to move up to the next higher occupation class for applicants who are at least 25% owners of their business. So to qualify for the upgrade, the business has to be financially successful for at least 2 years, and the way we determine that is that we look at 2 years of tax returns. So if you're going to do the business owner upgrade, then there is income documentation necessary in old-fashioned underwriting, but that's the only exception there. So that's the broad strokes of the programs. You can see pretty clearly why it's so simple. All the requirements, exams, APSs, personal history interviews, income documentation, are all waived for old-fashioned underwriting. Now, and this is a really important point, it doesn't mean that these cases aren't underwritten, because they certainly are, and they are underwritten thoroughly. They're just underwritten on the base of the information provided on the application, a fully completed, thoroughly completed application. And I really can't stress that point strongly enough. For an application to be considered under the old-fashioned underwriting program, the application has to be thoroughly completed. Now, we will call for an MIB and a script check report on each application, so it's very important that the applicant answer all questions thoroughly and honestly and give full disclosure. And that's where, if there is a problem, that's where it's going to come up, where they, if you have somebody who doesn't disclose completely on the application, and then on the MIB report or script check report, we get some very different information, and that can potentially kick the application out of the old-fashioned underwriting program. If you go to page 4, we'll talk about some of the finer strokes of the program. First, the maximum limit is issue limit is $5,000. And that includes any coverage under an SSI rider or a future purchase option rider. We will participate up to $6,500 with another carrier's fully underwritten IDI coverage. So if they already have $1,500 in place with another carrier that's been fully underwritten, they can still be eligible for the full $5,000 under old-fashioned underwriting. All occupation classes and issue ages are available. All waiting periods and benefits are available, although business owners in their first 2 years of business may be limited to a five-year benefit period, but other than that, whatever we normally offer is available through old-fashioned underwriting. And significantly, discounts are available for association and multi-life cases. So if you have, we offer a 10% discount for gender-neutral rates for approved associations, as well as a multi-life case, which we define as three lives for the same employer. So if you have a case that falls into either an approved association or a multi-life case, then old-fashioned underwriting can also be used along with those discounts. And then the business owner upgrade is also available, as I just mentioned just a few minutes ago. If we move to page 5, the following riders are available with old-fashioned underwriting, and it's pretty much the entire cast of characters that we offer. The non-CAN rider, which locks in the rates for the life of the policy, is available, as is the residual disability rider, which provides coverage for a partial disability. Our own occupation rider makes the policy a true own-oc policy, the ability to work in another occupation and still collect benefits under the base policy. Excuse me, and that's available for occupation class 3A and above. as it is in traditional underwriting. Our future purchase option rider is available that allows purchase of more coverage in the future when income goes up without the need for further medical underwriting. Now, we will, upon exercise of an FPO, we will require income documentation at that time because that's the only thing that that's the only underwriting required for the FPO is show qualification for the increase. So at the time of the FPO exercise, some income documentation will be required. The index cost of living, which raises the benefit level annually during a claim, is available. And our catastrophic disability benefit rider is available in all states where it's currently available. In California, unfortunately, it's not yet available. Hopefully, it will be soon. But in everywhere else it's available, it's also available through old-fashioned underwriting. And then lastly, the supplemental social insurance riders available through old-fashioned underwriting. Page 6 just indicates the two riders that are available if you're using old-fashioned underwriting for our business protector. And those two are residual and future purchase option riders. Those are available as well. Page 7 is very simple but extremely important information about how this program works. Three keys to the program success. First and foremost, they've got to fill out an application completely and fully disclose everything that the application calls for. And then when the application is submitted, you should indicate to us that it's old-fashioned underwriting, just write on the application, old-fashioned underwriting, or put that in the producer report, rather, so that we know that that's the route we're going to take, and we'll dispense with all the other underwriting requirements. And then lastly, and just as important as a thoroughly completed application, we need to keep a realistic goal for the result. And by that we mean we need to set reasonable expectations to the applicant. And what a lot of people who have found success with this program do is they sell the benefits of the program to the applicant, but they also explain to them that it's not a sure thing, that it's a great program if they qualify for it, but they set the expectation that let's fill out the application, thoroughly complete it, send it in, and if there are no significant health issues, it should sail right through old-fashioned underwriting, and that'll be the end of it. But set the expectation that that if something does come up in the underwriting of the case, we may have to come back for some additional information. If they have that expectation up front, then it's typically not it's not a surprise, and it's not a big issue when we do have to question a particular health issue, or we do have to go out and get a particular doctor's records. And when that does happen, the underwriters, at their discretion, do the very best to limit what they have to go back out for. In other words, if it's if there's a question about a particular health issue because there's an inconsistency between the answer on the application and, say, something in the MIB report or the script check, and it's limited in scope, they'll just go out and try to get information about that particular health issue. It won't necessarily kick it completely out of old-fashioned underwriting where you have to go back and get income documentation and have all the medical tests, et cetera. So they really do try to limit it, what they go out for after the fact. And it really depends on the scope of the issue. If an applicant just kind of clean sheets the application, answers no to everything, and there's all kinds of non-disclosures, then that's going to get kicked out of old-fashioned underwriting completely, and we're just going to take the traditional route. Okay, so the next page, page 8, is really just a picture of a marketing piece that we have. It's a two-piece marketing piece that basically summarizes all this information and more, some of the fine print, and some of the guidelines for old-fashioned underwriting. And it's the form number is 13485. And I would encourage you to, you know, to follow up with your local PLUS group representative for to get a copy of this this piece and any other marketing pieces that we have for old-fashioned underwriting. It goes through all the things that I've gone through so far and some other guidelines that are helpful in understanding the ins and outs of how this works. One thing that I would stress is that one of the questions that I get most commonly with old-fashioned underwriting is the notion that because there's not the full traditional underwriting done up front, there's concern that we just transfer the underwriting to the back end, to claim time. And some people are under the impression that it's just, it's claim time underwriting. And they are worried that there's going to be a problem at that point. My answer to that is always this. In every situation, our claims folks look at they do a thorough job of claim review, and they don't necessarily know that it's an old-fashioned underwriting case or a traditionally underwritten case. If a claim comes in the first 2 years of the policy's life, the claim folks are going to go out and get medical records to document the claim, whether it's old-fashioned underwriting or traditionally underwritten. And during that first 2 years, there is a contestability period. There's no difference. There's no additional underwriting that's done under old-fashioned underwriting at claim time versus traditional underwriting at claim time. What the claim folks look at is, did they fully disclose the information at the time of application, and did we rely on that information, and is it different now that we're looking at a claim? And if there is a significant disparity, then there can be a problem at claim time, no matter how it's underwritten. So the key is, again, a fully completed, honestly completed, thorough application and full disclosure, whether it's traditional or old-fashioned underwriting. And that doing that will take care of any problem at claim time. The only other two things that I wanted to mention about old-fashioned underwriting, as you can see, it really is pretty straightforward, is that if an applicant is offered a modified or rated coverage, or if the coverage is postponed or declined, the applicant can always have us ask us to obtain additional requirements and take the application out of old-fashioned underwriting into full underwriting, where we go out and get all of those medical records and see if we can make a better offer. And lastly, I just want to mention that old-fashioned underwriting is not available to someone who's been rated, modified, postponed, declined, or issued non-medical IDI coverage, guarantee issue coverage, in the past 10 years. So where it works best is somebody who has no or minimal medical issues, and to that end, we think that it's a great weapon to have in your arsenal. Again, if you're new to the business, new to disability, wrote disability at some point in the past, but have gone away from it because the process has been gotten too complicated. This is a great way to make it an easy re-entry for you, and an easy process for your customer. And that is that ends the formal presentation. Again, I would encourage you to contact your local PLUS Group office for more information. And if there are any questions, I'm happy to take them.
Okay, at this time, I would like to remind everyone that if you would like to ask a question or make a comment, please press 7 on your touch-tone keypad. Okay, and our first question comes from Della Chong.
Yes, I have a question.
Yes.
Oh, hi, Jim. I have a question. So you were talking about for the occupational classes for age 18 to 60. The occupational classes is you have various occupational classes. Like dentist is what kind of occupational classes will belong to dentist professional? How do I make clear to that?
Dentists are in our world. Dentists are 3P and 4P occupation classes, and old-fashioned underwriting is available to all those occupation classes. So if you're taking an application on a dentist. And it's for $5,000 or less, then you could use old-fashioned underwriting for that application. You just fill out the application as you normally would, and just indicate to us on the agent report that you want to use old-fashioned underwriting, and then we'll take it from there.
So you said what I would like to know is that the difference between the FPO and COLA. Now, future purchase option rider is that if this client has already have a $5,000 disability benefits applying for, and then after that, because his business is grow and he got more income and he want to increase the benefits, then that is called future purchase option rider. Am I right? And then you need the 2 years of tax income tax and prove that they have such and such amount of increased amount of money in income to get to that the maximum amount that they are requiring for. Is that called future purchase option rider?
The future purchase option rider allows them to purchase additional insurance in the future as their income goes up.
That's right. Right now they are having a $5,000, correct? He has a $5,000 existing disability. Now he wanted to increase it a few years from now because his income goes up, then he can increase it to $6,000, so $6,500 according to his income level. That would allow him to increase that, correct, if he has a future purchase option rider?
Well,
my rider so far.
Well, the limit, though, for old-fashioned underwriting is a $5,000 total coverage, including any old-fashioned underwriting. So if he has $5,000, if he goes through old-fashioned underwriting and gets $5,000 of base coverage, then that's the maximum that we'll issue under old-fashioned underwriting. If he wants a future purchase option on top of that, then that's outside of old-fashioned underwriting. That would have to be fully underwritten. If, conversely, let's say he wanted $3,000 now of coverage and another $2,000 of future purchase option coverage for a total of $5,000, that would work under old-fashioned underwriting.
So I have to go through with the regular underwriting there.
If you want more than $5,000 total of current coverage and future purchase option coverage, then yeah, that would be outside old-fashioned underwriting.
Now, we're not talking about the old-fashioned underwriting right now. I just wanted to differentiate between this future purchase option and index cost living, COLA. Now, in COLA, is what is the difference between that two?
Well, future purchase option allows you to get more coverage in the future as your income qualifies you. The COLA allows you to increase your benefit amount based on the cost of living adjustment once you're on claim. So that basically it allows your benefit amount to keep up with inflation. You go on claim you have $5,000 of benefit today, and you go on claim in a couple of years, and pretty soon that $5,000, as inflation rises, that $5,000 is worth less and less. So the COLA rider allows you to have an automatic adjustment while you're on claim, increasing your monthly benefit annually to keep up with inflation.
So if you have the cost of living, the COLA in it, when you purchase that rider in it. Now, if you are on claim, then that cost of living, let's say there's a 4% of the cost of living, and 4% will automatically increase to the benefits that clients is going to receive. Am I right?
Yeah, we have either a 3% or a 6%, and it maximum. So it's tied to the CPI. And after you've been on claim for 1 year, if you have the COLA rider, then that after a year and each year annually, each year after that, your benefit for that next year will go up according to that factor.
So the supplement social insurance, that means that if the person is receiving the social benefits, security, disability already, then if you are going to apply for the individual disability, it will coordinate with that social insurance. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, if you have coverage that's provided through the SSI rider, that amount can be offset by any kind of governmental benefits that you receive.
I see. Okay, got it. Okay, all right.
Okay, and our next question comes from Ira Richardson.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you for the presentation.
Sure.
Couple of questions. We're dealing with an obesity increase in the country. So for me sitting in front of a client or clients, can we get a height, weight, body mass chart that we can sort of make some on-the-spot judgments of whether to proceed with the old-fashioned underwriting?
Yeah, I think we used to provide that, and I thought that we still did in our...
Okay. I'll get back with our PLUS group folks.
Okay.
And get that. But just for my own education, height, weight is what we should focus, or should we be trying to discern body mass index?
Still height, weight.
Okay. Second question, we seem to have a lot of people my age, baby boomers, who are continuing their use of some sort of prescription drugs from the 60s. I've had a couple of cases denied for psychiatric medication for two reasons. One, they haven't been on the medication for more than a year, or their physician has recommended improvements or changes in the medication, and they hadn't been on the they've changed the medication too many times. Is if the client discloses any kind of psychiatric or depression or behavior modification, ADD, whatever, is that an automatic no on the old-fashioned underwriting?
Well, the problem in answering that is it's so, I don't want to say it's an automatic kick out of old-fashioned underwriting, because it really depends on the circumstances. They, kind of psychiatric issues and depression and the use of those drugs really span such a wide range of uses and severity and all that. And there certainly has been, a little more enlightenment towards, some of the varied uses of some of these drugs. So just because somebody is on a drug that was, traditionally used for depression or something related, doesn't necessarily eliminate them from consideration. So it really depends on the situation, and the underwriter would have to weigh in and look at the at the details and the situation and to see what we can do. They really try to be as open as they can to you know, to some of those changes that have been implemented. I'm not sure if that answers your question, but
well, again, if the client in the pre-discovery discloses they are on Zoloft or something, what kind of question should we ask them to discern whether old-fashioned underwriting is something we should even approach them with? Because again, I've had two cases with you guys decline. One from a doctor who had a really horrible divorce, and she was being seen by a psychiatrist, and you know, she was a full-time family physician seeing 100 patients a day in a hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And I had another physician decline because he'd gone through a lawsuit, a malpractice lawsuit, which he won, but it greatly depressed him.
Took a toll on him, yeah.
Yeah, so you guys declined both because for the female physician, she had changed medications because her psychiatrist thought she was making improvements, so she changed the dose and the type of medication. And the male physician, he had not been on the medication for a year, so you guys declined both. So when I hear somebody on a depression medicine, what question should I ask myself before we proceed with a old-fashioned underwriting?
Well, I think what the underwriters look at is certainly the length of time, the stability of the condition, the reason for its use, the specific condition. You know, is it situational? Is it longstanding? Is it under control? Is it stable? And I think that's why they look at you know, if they see somebody who's recently changed medications or recently been put on medication, then it's harder for them to determine that it's a stable situation, and I think that sort of thing makes them nervous. So, I mean, just in general, I think it's questions like, what's the reason? What's the what are the facts behind it? How long? How stable is the diagnosis, how severe the diagnosis, that sort of thing.
All right, thank you.
Okay. Well, and, you know, I just, in our underwriting, our product guide, under the underwriting guidelines section, there is a height-weight chart that gives some rating in percentages.
Have you seen that chart be increased to recognize the increasing weight gain of the general American population, or
I don't know when this was last updated. I've always seen it as ridiculously low because that means I'm obese, so it can't be right. Right?
I'm seeing a lot of 6 feet, 250 pound men, and 5 feet, 200-pound women. So
yeah.
Would either one of those qualify under the old-fashioned underwriting?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you could still have it doesn't necessarily kick you out of old-fashioned underwriting. It may be that the offer is rated.
Yeah.
And if there's a reason for you know, to reconsider that rating because you know, they're an athlete, and on the chart they may be over the you know, the standard weight and height, you know, but they're a top performing athlete, and there's a reason for it, then that additional information can be offered to the underwriter to, you know, to address that.
Great. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
And our next question comes from Paul Woodsky.
Hi there. Following up on that, the last fellow's question, and then I have a question of my own, is the back on the depression or medication thing. It seems to me, though, that if this is correct, that any listing, excuse me, on the application of Zoloft or what have you, for example, that's going to immediately trigger, as it would in regular underwriting, an APS for more information. Is that a fair statement?
It may for that, yeah. For that one, and again, it depends on, you know, the totality of the application. If there's a whole lot of things going on, then that may kick the entire thing out of old-fashioned underwriting into traditional underwriting. If that's the only issue and corroborated by the MIB and script check, then the additional underwriting may be just limited to that issue.
Okay. And then maybe a bigger picture question. I'm just having been in the business for 25 years now, and so I'm still healing. My scars are still healing.
I'm sorry.
Jack and Diana are helping me get past that. But
you're in good hands.
From a standard product and profitability standpoint, it looks to me like you all have assessed what the balancing of the risk of really gauging or underwriting based solely on a combination of what's in the MIB and the accuracy and completeness of an application with some increase in DI business, because there's got to be increased morbidity risk, it seems to me, in this product area where someone answers, let's say they answered honestly and they, quote, forgot. I can't tell you the number of people who say, oh, yeah, I forgot about that after the fact when the APS comes in. So if they forgot conveniently or honestly, then, and it's past the two-year period, and maybe it doesn't come out at the claims underwriting, and you say that there's no difference, that they're going to look at, even past 2 years, your claims adjusters are going to look at medical history, but maybe it just didn't show up. So there's an increased risk there, I think, from a product viability standpoint. Mm-hmm. But you've obviously contemplated that.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. The actuaries and underwriters and product development folks have determined that, you know, we've got a good balance. That it's a if there is increased risk, that we've offset it by, you know, the limitations that we have and by the discretion of the underwriter, and the secondary check by MIB and script check.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks. Looks great. Mm-hmm. Thanks very much.
You bet.
Okay, and our next question comes from Mark Bowden.
Yes, thank you, Tom. I'm kind of at the other end of the spectrum. I've been working with groups and group DI for only a couple of years and just dabbling now in the individual market, so I apologize for not understanding what some of the acronyms are that you've mentioned, so I thought I'd just throw them out. Maybe someone else doesn't know either, but so, for example, I don't know what MIB or script report or the last gentleman's APS is referring to.
MIB is Medical Information Bureau, and most companies subscribe to that, so if you have if they issue a modified offer, then that is reported to the MIB. A variety of things are reported to the MIB, so it's just kind of a clearinghouse for general information on applicants.
Okay.
Script check is most pharmacies. I think the only organization that main organization that doesn't subscribe to this is Kaiser, I believe, but most other pharmacy chains and independents report to script check. So an insurance company can get a report on an applicant's prescription history.
Oh, okay.
And that's pretty telling if they answer a no to everything, but they're on seven different medications.
Mm-hmm.
Something is amiss.
Okay.
And then APS is attending physician statements. So just medical doctor records.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Because you can't say doctor records. You have to have your own language, right? You have
yep.
to confuse people.
Okay.
Okay, and our next question comes from Jim Scarborough.
Hi, Jim.
Hi.
I do a lot of group business, and I was wondering if this is something that we can use to supplement the group LTD.
Any of this can be used with this can be used with any other LTD coverage. We will participate up to 6,500 with other IDI, but if they already have LTD in place, that won't necessarily affect old-fashioned underwriting. I mean, they can get additional individual insurance, traditionally or old-fashioned underwriting. Same, it's the same.
Okay, so for
same
example,
participation.
So with the max issue limit of 5,000, we're not going to count the current LTD benefit against that 5,000.
We have another chart that shows what we participate with in both individual and group coverage.
Okay.
And so it would just fit into that chart.
Yeah.
You know, we have issue and participation limits on both.
Good. Thank you.
You bet.
And I show there are currently no questions at this time.
Okay, great. Jim, thank you so much. And I just would like to say, anybody has any additional questions, please feel free to contact your local Plus Group office. We have recorded this call, and once we receive the tape, we'll be hanging a recorded copy of this presentation on our website at www.plusgroupus.com. And I want to thank everybody again and hope that you will join us next month on February 17th for our live audio conference entitled Market Trends and Industry Resources, and will be presented by Principal Financial. Again, thank you, everyone, and hope to see you next month. Thank you, Jim.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This concludes today's conference. Thank you for your participation.